Tea podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
On May the 4th, a lawyer named Thomas Dunlap made news in the technology press by announcing that he had collected over 23,000 IP addresses of people who had used BitTorrent to illegally download The Expendables, an action movie starring Sylvester Stallone. Does that mean that Dunlap will actually be able to find the downloaders and sue them? It probably does, and here's why. You might think your IP address can't be easily traced back to you, but whenever you make an HTTP request in a browser, your IP address is included in the header of the request so that the server knows where to respond to. Go to a website like whatismyip.com and it'll show you the IP address that your browser sent. Okay, you say, but how can that be tied to me? Is the IP address of my computer fixed? Well, no, it probably isn't. When you're at home, for example, the computer that you use likely gets an IP address allocated dynamically using the DHCP protocol from a firewall between your home network and the network of your internet service provider. And that IP address is private anyway. The firewall, the box connecting your home network to the ISP, has its own IP address, but again, that address is allocated by DHCP too. So from day to day, the IP address that the outside world sees when you make browser requests is constantly changing. How then can you be traced? Well, your ISP, which runs that DHCP service, keeps logs and knows which IP addresses were assigned to which customers at which times. So if you have access to the log, you can identify the customer from the IP address. You might think that ISPs were obliged to keep this kind of thing secret. In fact, though, they even sell some of it. If you look online, you'll find many services that map IP addresses to physical locations. I entered my own IP address on some of these. The first one I tried said my IP address was owned by Verizon, my ISP, and it placed me physically at Verizon's offices in downtown Boston, the city I live in. The second one I tried did better. It produced a location less than half a mile from my home. My guess is that the company running the second site had bought data from Verizon that maps IP address ranges to neighborhoods. It's not hard to imagine how valuable such information is for marketing. In fact, according to one article, and there's a link to this in the blog post associated with the podcast, ISPs make almost as much money selling information about your IP address as they do for providing you with the IP address. Back to Thomas Dunlap, the lawyer. What made Mr. Dunlap very happy, and what will make tens of thousands of people very unhappy, is that a judge recently ruled in his favor, allowing him to subpoena internet service providers, forcing them to release their IP address records. When Mr. Dunlap gets the names and addresses of the 23,000 people who downloaded the movie, he'll be sending each of them a letter offering them a settlement. U.S. copyright law actually allows for a penalty of $150,000 for each instance of willful copyright infringement. Typically, Mr. Dunlap's company requests $3,000 in return for not pursuing the case, and many people will pay up. From a legal and social perspective, this is an interesting topic. Downloading pirated movies is clearly illegal, but Mr. Dunlap's approach is, in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, a form of extortion. He's using the courts and automated technology to cull a huge number of targets. He says he's after 140,000 people in total. And then threaten them with payments that for many are quite debilitating. He's relying on the fact that in the United States, at least, getting a lawyer to defend you is so expensive that some people will pay up even if they're innocent. And just because an ISP says an IP address was assigned to you, that doesn't mean it was you who committed the offense. In a recent case, police raided a house for child pornography, but found none. It turned out that the owner's wireless network was open, and it was a neighbor who'd been downloading the illegal material. In fact, suing downloaders is becoming such good business that the copyright owners of unsuccessful B-rated movies are finding that they can make more money this way than they could ever have dreamed of making by actually selling movie rights. In one bizarre cases, two companies are squabbling over who owns a film with the ridiculous title Nude Nuns with Guns, which has been widely downloaded and offers a lucrative pot of targets for extortion of the sort that Mr. Dunlap practices. So much for the social and legal side of movie downloading. There's a bigger issue here, though, and that's the question of what's happening to our privacy. We need privacy for all kinds of legitimate reasons. Whistleblowers need privacy so that their companies can't take revenge against them. Dissidents and human rights advocates need privacy to avoid government oppression. Consumers need privacy in their final financial transactions to keep criminals from stealing their money and identity, and so on. But modern communication systems make privacy harder and harder to achieve. It's not just computers. When you make a phone call, your phone number identifies you. You might think you can hide your identity by using a disposable SIM card, but it's not so easy. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, an Al-Qaeda operative, got caught by doing exactly that, since he mistakenly took a card from a batch that had already been used and traced. And it turns out that your phone handset has an identifier too, so just changing the SIM card isn't enough. When talking about living in a global electronic village, we're usually thinking of the benefits of easy communication. The fact that you might be sitting now in Shanghai or Madrid or Bangalore listening to a podcast that I'm recording here in Boston. But remember that in a village, everyone knows what everyone else is doing, and that's the downside of rich communication mechanisms. From a security perspective, it's worth noting that privacy involves two completely different aspects. On the one hand, there's confidentiality, keeping the message you send secret. On the other hand, there's anonymity, keeping secret not the message itself, but the identity of the sender. In different contexts, only one or both of these might matter. The whistleblower, dissident, and illegal downloader care only about anonymity. How do you get anonymity online? Several anonymizing services are available. There are private companies, such as anonymizer.com. There are also free services, most notably Tor, which has several hundred thousand users. Human rights workers, for example, use Tor in combination with Skype to enable conversations that can't be traced. The concept behind anonymizers like Tor is quite simple and is based on an idea developed by David Shaum in the 1980s. Instead of your browser communicating directly with the destination server, it sends its packets to an intermediary, a proxy in NetSpeak. These packets include the IP address of the sending machine and of the target, but are encrypted with the public key of the proxy. The proxy decrypts the packets using its private key and forwards them to the destination. Now, these forward packets no longer refer to the original sender. The destination server replies to the proxy, and the proxy passes the message back to the original client. The obvious disadvantage in this scheme is that if the proxy is compromised, an attacker can match incoming and outgoing messages and figure out the initiating IP address for a given message that reached the server. So what systems like Tor actually do is to arrange a series of proxies, three in the case of Tor, that pass the packets one to another. Each proxy unwraps one layer of encryption, revealing the IP address of the next proxy in the chain and passes on the message. Because this unwrapping is like peeling an onion, it's called onion routing. And Tor, in fact, stands for the onion router. So does this mean the problem is solved? Unfortunately not. There are many ways in which your identity can be revealed, even if you're using a service such as Tor. Problem number one, the underlying protocol is not perfect. A sniffer can observe packets going in and out of proxies and can correlate them. Anonymizers do shuffle messages to subvert attacks that rely on timing, but this means that they inevitably damage latency, so that privacy and performance are at odds. Problem number two is that when the traffic emerges from the last proxy, called the exit node, it can't any longer be encrypted, unless the web server you're communicating with uses encryption. A risk is that information that identifies you might actually be in the body of the message, not just in its headers. In peer-to-peer networks, such as BitTorrent, for example, the IP address of the client can appear in the message, so even if an attacker can't tell what path a message took, The message might reveal its origin right there in the body of the message itself. In fact, one famous attack on anonymizers used a malicious exit node to collect outgoing messages and was able to get account names and passwords for the email accounts of people working at embassies who were using the anonymizer to communicate with an email server, but made the mistake of sending messages in the clear. Problem number three is that your client might be communicating with the server through other channels that aren't being anonymized, for example, a Flash plugin or Java, and it's very hard to tell without turning off all plugins what communication paths are actually open. Problem number four is that you might be revealed simply by sending messages to a machine that is known to be an anonymizing proxy. In an oppressive regime, that might be enough to get you into trouble. It's thought that this is the reason that the US Navy, which developed Tor for its own purposes, made the system public. By dramatically increasing the number of users, it becomes easier to hide in the masses. If you're a spy in Tehran, for example, you won't be caught connecting to an anonymizer if all of your neighbors are using the same anonymizer to download illegal movies. Problem number five, the final one on my list, is more mundane. Maybe the anonymizer would work fine, but you just failed to set it up correctly. This is a much more important point than many people realize. Doug Tigar, a former colleague of mine at Carnegie Mellon University, did a study with a student of his called Alma Witten, in which they gave a dozen people a PGP plugin for encrypting email and asked them to send encrypted messages. Only 3 of the 12 were able to do it successfully, and several of the ones who'd set it up wrong believed that they were in fact sending encrypted email when in fact they weren't. Now, admittedly, the PGP plugin was very badly designed and poorly integrated, and understanding how to set up public key cryptography pairs is pretty hard. But the point is still important and worth bearing in mind, since configuring machines and packages is a complex and error-prone business. So what are the lessons we can learn from this? First of all, don't download movies illegally, unless you want to get a letter from Thomas Dunlap. Secondly, think carefully about which servers you communicate with and what kind of data you send. There are many good reasons to protect your privacy that you might not have considered. And finally, if you find yourself in a situation in which you really need privacy, be extremely careful and don't put too much faith in technology.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.